So suppose we're back in the 60s, whenever this was formulated, and we know a little bit about it, but we're trying to account for the protons. And suppose we've already figured out that it makes sense to regard mesons and hadrons as being made up of two or three quarks. So we think that proton is made up of three quarks. And we want to write down the wave function for the ground state of these three quarks. So we've got an up and an up and a down quark in some sort of bound state. And we don't know much about that yet. But what do we know about the wave function? So we've got this composite particle, right? It's built out of the wave functions of three particles. What do we know about the ground state? What would you expect for the symmetry of the ground state?
It's anti-symmetry. Or it's a fermion. So
it's a fermion, so the total wave vector for this has got to be anti-symmetric. That's right. But for a composite particle, the ground state is usually a symmetric. The spatial wave function for the ground state is usually symmetric. It's kind of easy to see. I'm talking about the spatial wave function here, because there are spin parts and stuff. You like this symmetric because that gets you to the lowest potential. If you've got say the origin at the center and you've got an anti-symmetric wave function and you square it to get the probability distribution, this would be phi squared, it's way away from the origin. This is anti-symmetric. But for a symmetric wave function, you've got this, so you square it and phi squared is near the origin where the potential is biggest, the potential is deepest. You're in a potential well, so this puts everything at a lower energy. So the symmetric spatial wave function is, this is lower energy. So you expect a symmetric ground state. So some kind of wave function for these three, who knows, what the wave function really looks like, but because you've got some complicated potential that you don't really know yet. But, symmetric spatial wave function. What else goes into that wave function? Well, you know that you have spin.
We expect to be symmetric for the wave, for the spatial part? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we expect that to be symmetric. Right. How about the spin wave function? What do we expect there? Well, we know what the spin of the proton is. Spin 1/2. How do you get that from three spins? You've got a half, rod and a half, rod and a half. So there are eight possible spin states here. So you've got a 3/2 M state. That accounts for four of them. And let's see. If you get a 1/2 M, that's two. You probably have two ways of forming in the spin half thing. Let's see, is there a totally anti-symmetric combination of these? Not really. We'd have to work out the Coxcordian coefficients to be sure of how that breaks down, but let's not do that today. But, you're going to have you know, some anti-symmetry here. But then you have another set of quantum numbers to worry about. You have the it's a weak doublet. Okay, so we have this up and this down quark under the weak interaction. So there's isospin. Isospin 1/2 for each of these particles. So, you know, the up are plus 1/2 isospin, the down is minus 1/2 isospin. It's completely analogous to the spin wave function. But it's not spin, so they call it isospin, just, you know, who knows what they call it. Okay, well, the problem is when you work this out in detail, the total wave function is symmetric. When you combine these with the symmetric spatial wave function, you end up with a totally symmetric overall wave function for something that you know has to be anti-symmetric because it's a fermion. These things have to be odd. So what people figured correctly, it has turned out, is that there must be some quantum number missing. You need to assign one more quantum number to these things. And that quantum number is in fact what's responsible for it being a baryon.
Yeah, but why is this?
The overall wave function needs to be anti-symmetric. And if you put in the known properties, the spatial distribution and spin and isospin of the constituent quark, and work out, you know, what should be the lowest energy state, it turns out to be a symmetric wave function, not anti-symmetric. So what you need is one more quantum number where you can fold in some totally anti-symmetric contribution. And the so you invent one. And well, let's call it color. With a little foresight. Color, because you don't know what it is. It's, you know, some property that you want to assign to the different quark. But now, how can we? The question is, how many colors do there need to be? Right. We need to be able to make a totally anti-symmetric combination. Well, you've got three things here. How many colors do you need to be able to make a totally anti-symmetric combination? You can't anti-symmetrize, totally anti-symmetrize three things that only have two states because you get zero. You know, and that's why these don't do it for you. But the, you know, something that has three different possible colors, you can anti-symmetrize over, like, a red quark, a green quark, and a blue quark, and you come up with a singlet. That's totally anti-symmetric. There's one totally anti-symmetric combination of three things. And so you assume that this is in that. So now you get the right symmetry for the proton. You get coming out of the fermion and having the right combinatorial properties. Well, this leads to the consideration of another symmetry.
Who thought of this?
You know, I was trying to remember. You know, Zweig and Gell-Mann. Zweig and Gell-Mann were both, you know, working on three particle quark system.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of
aces.
Yeah. What's that?
Aces.
Is what aces. Zweig, yeah. Zweig called them aces. Three aces. Like he played poker and Gell-Mann read Sin Against Wave. And so we ended up with quarks. those things that come in threes.
Except aces come in fours, but nobody's counting.
What's that?
Except aces come in fours, but...
Yeah, really. You know, and then, yeah, you get
the deck card.
Yeah, then you need
charms,
right? You need the charm card. You know, and then along comes Kobayashi and the sellers and say, oh, no, there are two more. Now, you're going to get shot because you're cheating. You got six aces. okay, so Toby and Andy Commander come in. So you have a red quark, and you have a blue quark, and you have a green quark. Clean. And you totally anti-symmetrize those colors while you symmetrize the spatial wave function, and you can get this totally anti-symmetric combination. Well, this works great. Now you say, well, you know, what if I do some transformations? You know, I can take a 3x3 transformation on a red and a green and a blue and come up with a red prime, green prime, blue prime, and you know, the action that gives me something like this is going to be invariant under that.
Quick question.
Yeah.
To anti-symmetrize this, you just change two at a time, right? And subtract it off.
You get a minus sign for any pair interchange.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so this is, that anti-symmetrization is 1 over 3 factorial times, you know, you red, you blue, plus the symmetric permutation minus the anti-symmetric permutation. So you blue, what's it down here? Green, red, green, red, blue, minus, and now the odd permutation, green, blue. So now, if I flip those, you get a minus sign. And then if I permute those cyclically, I'll get the two that correspond here. Green, blue, red, minus, blue, blue, green. So that's what I mean by there. And now, all right, that's just the colors. Now, each of these is a wave function, and then we want to symmetrize that total product wave function. So, you know, this is the same problem you've been having, you know, you know, looking at all of these different theories at once, is that you've got an awful lot of different phases at the same time. So you've got color space, and you've got real estate space, and you've got spin space, and isospin space, and all. Okay, so we introduce color, and these are going to be elements of SU3. SU3 transformations are going to leave these objects invariant, and so you write an SU3 invariant theory, and now you know that, oh, I've got a symmetry, I can gauge it. You introduce gauge bosons for these things, 8 gauge bosons, and now you've got a Stigler. So, this is the kind of reasoning that led to the introduction of color symmetry by Feig and Johann.
I ran out of batteries, so I have to do the class before.
So let's look at what happens in that three gauge theory. So, what do you expect these gauge particles to do?
Oh, sure. How do you know it's SU3, not SO3?
Well, let's see. Everything else is complex. You would probably want the fundamental representation. You know, that's pretty much the rule. If you want to get... you want to maximize the number of transformations. Find all that there are. I mean, you could gauge SO3. Certainly, that would be a symmetry of this. But
Was SE2 symmetry known before this? The SE2 symmetry? All right.
Not electroweak, but the weak symmetry was described by SE2. See, that was probably the first Yang-Mills theory, right? Back in the 50s. So, yeah.
So SE3 would have been...
I would say SE2 was, I would have been... It was seen early, it wasn't associated with quarks, of course, because they were developed by Gell-Mann and Zweig later, but these isospin doublets, the first isospin doublets to be identified was the proton-neutron pair. They're very close in mass, they have very similar properties, and, so maybe they could be different states of a doublet, and it's just some kind of isospin flip that turns you from a proton to a neutron and back again. So the proton is some kind of a spin-up thing, isospin up, and the neutron is some kind of isospin down. And early on, they envisioned the pion. Okay, the pion is a meson, which we now see is comprised of an up, anti, down, or various combinations of up, down, and strange quarks. The symmetric combinations of quark, anti quark pairs gives the trigger. Right? And those are the pi naught and the pi plus and the pi minus. And the idea originally for the weak interaction was that, or no, sorry, for the strong interaction was that the proton and the neutron were going to exchange pions. So the nucleus was viewed as the baryons exchanging pions to accomplish the strong interaction. And what happened then was people said, how do you make a pion? Well, you can flip it around and see the pions is exchanging the protons and neutrons. It's called the bootstrap model. The image of hauling oneself up by one's own bootstrap. Each thing was kind of the force that bound the other, and it was a strange idea and yielded pretty quickly to the quark picture, which really accounted for the whole zoo of particles that people were seeing. The original Yang-Mills paper was, I think, 56, 57, something like that. I don't know. You probably have that paper, right? Utsiyama was talking about, actually standard model symmetry back in the 50s. 56 was Utsiyama's paper. And did he have SE3 in that one? Suddenly I'm wondering when people were thinking about the SE3. I know he does U1 and SU2, and he does the Lorentz gauging in that paper. But, this is very early stuff. This is more than 50 years ago. Any other questions?
About the isospin?
Yeah.
Is that number arbitrary?
Well, the plus or minus a half.
Yeah.
Well, you have a two-state system. How did it work? The picture that gradually developed was one that related the weak hypercharge. So, you also had a weak hypercharge. And I think the assignment of weak hypercharge to both of these was plus a half. And so you could assign an electric charge quantum number as being the hypercharge plus the isospin. You know, so, you, formulas like this where you combine these to get quantum numbers. So you combine these and you get 1 and 0 here for, you know, the charges of the proton and the neutron. So, you know, gradually, the quantum numbers that arise naturally from the fundamental structure of the group, well, SU2 does have a plus or minus a half eigenvalue.
Right.
You know, you're pretty much locked into that. But then by combining it in different ways with other quantum numbers, you can come up with things you're more familiar with. So, it does need to be plus or minus a half. But what were you thinking of? Somewhere you're headed with that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have any units, right? Plus or minus a half. You know?
Oh, yeah, so, right. So half unit of
isotopes. So they seem like it could be arbitrary. There's no units anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there are eigenvalues of SU2, but, you can rescale your generators. Associated with these group symmetries, you have charges. So, you know, this is one half unit of isospin charge, whatever that is. And people didn't worry too much about what it was. You know, they wanted to account for the particle spectrum they were seeing in accelerator collisions and were able to do it by this. And, you know, what emerged after a decade or so was the standard bomb. This is one of the things, and you know, it turns out that there is more than one way to do this. You're familiar with the assigned quark charges of plus 2/3 for the up term and top quark, minus 1/3 for the downstage and bottom. But there's another model where they have integer charges. You can actually consistently account for the spectrum of particles with, integer assignments. You have to do some other things somewhere else to compensate, but it's not totally unique. You could assign the charges different ways. If one could free up a quark and measure the charge, people look for fractional charges for a long time. But Cabrera, the only person in the world who has seen a free quark. He measured a 1/3 charge, at the 2/3 charge, I forget which it was. The idea was that you might see some primordial matter, going around carrying, having one excess quark or something. So all you need is a circuit loop that charge just passes through. You get, a quantum of EMF pulse through your loop. So you have to measure it very carefully and cool it down to near absolute zero, but that's not all terrifically hard to do. Modulo any experiment is terrifically hard to do, but, conceptually it's a simple thing to set up. And he actually sees a pulse of just the right amount, and it turns out that, other groups were doing similar things and had realized that there's an electronic glitch that can give you just that much of a pulse, spuriously. And, the thinking is that's probably what happened. It wasn't great. And nobody replicated the experiment. I mean, people have tried to replicate the results, but nobody sees any free fractional charges. But if at some point somebody did, that would certainly confirm the usual interpretation. Or if somebody demonstrably freed up a quark and measured its charge to be 1 instead of minus 1/3, then you say, oops, we probably should use this other model. But until you can measure it, the one model is as good as the other. One might be more cumbersome than the other. And of course, that matters. You want a model that's elegant because you want it to give you pictures and suggest experiments and be easy to work with. And I don't know whether one or the other is simpler to work with. You did a good job on that. you know, maybe Pateed working on that one, and future. A lot of people are involved in all this.
What was the second name?
Future. F-U-T-H-E-R. You ever run into Future? He was at, might still be at U of Maryland. Worked with some people. There's a well-known paper by Pati and Salam. But again, I'm not sure on him, but other things Future worked on. Dozens of people contributed bits and pieces to all of this.
I was going to say, LHC is back online.
The what?
LHC is back online.
Yeah.
Did you see the article?
The paper has been published.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. In a week. It took them a week to review it, turn around, and get it in print. It's got 226 authors.
Oh, my God.
The author list, you know, the footnotes for the author location, you know, they did A, B, C, D, you know, through Z, and then A, 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 B, A, C.
It's like an Excel.
They got up like N, A, N, B, N, C.
Oh my gosh.
Well over 200 authors. Alphabetized.
I must have been already
half the week to get that together.
A lot of people build any experiment. This is a result from Atlas, one of the detectors. You know, the detector's the size of an apartment building, right? You know, these things are huge. And it takes hundreds of people to build that and test it and monitor it and get it all working. And, you know, they own the location. So they're going to be reporting on everything that comes out of that device first.
My question is, who reviews those papers? Because everyone who does that stuff is working on it.
Well, yeah,
that's right. Like everybody in the world is.
A lot of the high energy systems in the United States are working at CERN and collaborating. But, you know, there are a lot more than 200 particle physicists out there. And probably have a list really handy. That's our point.
I mean, when you have to make a citation from that
time
to go
out. What are citations?
At all, you know.
Aardvark et al. Yeah, you don't.
Our local paper this morning had a CERN article saying that they got to, I think, 2.36 TeV.
3.5 is what I heard they were running at.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, they had
a 7 TeV collision.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, that would be 3.5.
3.5 on a TeV.
Right.
Yeah, it's design energy. Of course, 7 needs to be in, so they can do 14 TeV of center of mass energy. But they still have these bad joints. Apparently, it's the joints between the magnets that were not adequately. What's the term for it?
Soldered.
Well, the
that was the first problem.
Yeah, they do fluctuation analysis on these things to see, you know, well, what are the extreme conditions that might need. So, you know, the engineering specs on this, you know, have to stand, you know, certain margins, and that study was done wrong, so they didn't have, you know, sufficient. Probably sufficient cooling in those joints or something to handle variations, fluctuations in the current that much recently has been expected. It, of course, happened. I just imagine a ton of liquid helium on the floor.
I've read that it cost $40 million to repair.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And, it's probably wrong at 10.
It takes 3 months to cool the thing. You have to bring it up to to room temperature, then you've got to pump liquid helium in 27 miles of, you know, piping to cool it back down to, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 Kelvin, wherever it is, to make those magnets superconducting. You know, just that cool down process takes you 3 months. You know, 40 million, yeah, sure. Yeah, I would stand around and, you know, pump liquid helium for 3 months for less than 40 million. I would actually. 40 million would be 20, but you know, there's a lot of work to do that. You know, they only have a few access elevators to the, you know, places where they can lower those magnets down into the tunnel, and then they have a train that runs around the tunnel. So, you know, they'd have to lower a new magnet, and then they have to run it by train, you know, 10 miles in the tunnel. Well, like, you know, those things are not going to move fast. They're not going to go at 60 miles an hour through that tunnel. You know, it's a day-long process to get a magnet just to the position where you need to install it. A lot of work involved in putting something like that together. It's quite an engineering feat. The superconducting super collider that was started down in Texas would have been 20 TeV.
Oh, wow.
Would have been,
or the center of mass energy?
Articles at that point.
Yeah.
You know, that might have been beam.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, much higher energy than that. But,
Bunch.
Oh, well, you know, we're busy dreaming up creation of theories of the universe or something. Have more important things to do.
It's funny, I've heard now like 3 or 4 articles. It would be what we were talking about in the colloquium yesterday. There's some people who do not know how to talk about particle physics to news organizations. And, I mean, it was mostly the reporter, and it's just like, it would be fun actually as an assignment to go and just fact check everybody because people are saying ridiculous things.
What was the colloquium?
The colloquium was about, well, part of it was about educating scientists to be able to talk to the press.
Yeah.
This is one of those. People were using way too many superlatives.
Yeah. The God particle.
Right, exactly. It's about a superlative thing.
Yeah, although, you know, as we develop this model, take note of how many places the Higgs gets used. You know, it's in about half of the terms of the standard model Lagrangian. You know, it's important that there be something there. It may not have to be the Higgs, but if the Higgs is not seen, then, you know, there's a scramble to figure out what the next simplest thing to do to provide these particles the perfect masses is. But we'll get to that. So QCD, let's see what we got. We've got, all right, so QCD is an SU3 A3. We've already basically written down the gauging last time. So what we ended up with was an action for the strong sector of the quark that, you know, what do we call the field? We call this one F. Was it a
big
and
heavy? Oh, well.
Yeah. Okay, good. From 1 to the number of generators would be 8. And then we have a bunch of quark wave functions for varying derivatives and the mass. And we're going to sum this over the various quarks. We're going to sum over the various colors. So we're going to add identical terms for each color. So there will be 3 terms that look just like this, 1 for red, 1 for green, 1 for blue. Happily, there's no experimental evidence to suggest that we need to do anything differently than that pure arrangement. Of course, you know, we haven't seen any color excited states. Right? We've only seen these ground states, so who knows what color dependence math has for us. you know, there may be some mixings that occur that are unexpected. You know, once you get to energy levels where you actually are producing excited color states, you know, who knows what could happen. It could get complicated here too.
On that second term, where is the C cycling?
Well, we can put a color index on here.
Okay.
So each spinner has a color. So we're going to sum over the three colors, and then we're going to sum over all of the quarks. And until we worry about the weak interaction, we don't really need to worry about the quarks being in weak doublets. Right? So these could be like this could be an up down doublet. So we could put a weak index on here and sum over the weak index, and then we'd be summing those doublets. It's something we'll get at a later stage. This covariant derivative, certainly we want this SU3 covariant. And eventually we want it electroweak covariant as well. And fortunately, these groups come in direct product. So what that means is, in a covariant derivative of the spinner, we have the partial, and then we have a connection for each group. We've got some gauge fields, so our gluon gauge field has an alpha and an A, and then we've got group generators, lambda A, and those are matrices that know how to act on these spinners. Well, for the commuting electroweak interaction, we can just add the connection for electroweak. So that will come out here. And it would involve the generators of the SU2+SU1 symmetries. So we won't write those just now. We're just going to focus on the strong part. These lambda A's we wrote before. I think I didn't write them quite right. The thing online has them almost right, except there's one where there should be an I, and I'll fix that for the next iteration. I just posted a new version of the PDF this morning. So in various places there's more. That's coming along. So the first three of these replicate the Pauli matrices in the upper corner. So we get minus I, lambda 3 is like sigma z, so we do the diagonal one next in the numbering. Okay, then lambda 4, we move off diagonal here, and I may still be getting these numbers wrong, but let's just press on. Lambda 5, lambda 6, like I say, these are the right matrices. I'm not sure I'm writing in the numbers in exactly the right order, but there's one here, there's a lambda 7, we have I, minus I down there. And wait, we have too many things, right? No, 8. We want one more. One minus two. One more diagonal. Okay. So these are our generators, and the thing we want to do with them is what we're particularly interested in is the terms and the actions that give the interaction between the gauge particles and the various quarks. So the interaction term is going to be where this part of the covariant derivative connects the two quarks. sidebar some particular quirk. Then the ID flash, well, let's go ahead and put in a strong coupling constant here. So what do I call the strong coupling constant? What do you know? I don't think I've got it here. Now, let's just put an I over 2. I know there's an I over 2 on some of the other ones. Let's assume there's an I over 2 here. That'll make these generators Hermitian, which is what they are, so we know we need an I at any rate. Then the 2 might or might not help. But the interaction term, then, we have the I over 2, we have it's a D slash, let's see, I guess we get minus a half, because here's an I, and there's an I here. And then what we have is the gate sealed with a gamma. So it's really a G alpha A slash. Just like the A slash that comes in the QED interaction. And then, it's fine. So this is the kind of thing that we're looking at. And what this G is a Lie algebra value thing, so there's a generator in there. So what we're really looking at, okay, two spaces at once again, right? What do we have? And each of these things comes in three colors. So we've got phi red, mar, phi green, red, green. Let's try and keep the same order. Blue and green. So we've got these triplets. Then there's a gamma alpha floating around. Then we have this G alpha A summed on the lambda. So G alpha A lambda A. That lambda is a 3x3 matrix that sees these vectors. And then we have a phi red, phi blue, phi green. Okay, so let's go ahead and multiply some of this out. You can take these extreme measures with any of the stuff we write. You can just expand and expand and expand. To really see what's happening, you kind of have to do that. So let's look at one term where we've got our colors, by green. There's a gamma alpha. What is this gamma alpha doing?
On the space of the spinner, each spinner has right. Another.
Each of these things is a Dirac spinner.
Oh, okay.
Right. So you get one term, you multiply all this out, you get one term, and now that's really two Dirac spinners spinning that gamma. Okay, so you're going to have a sum of like 9 terms that look like that. So we'll write out as much as, maybe we'll write the first term of the 9, and then expand that one. Just to see what's happening.
Just multiply the spinners. Each of these spinners?
Yeah, so each of these is a spinner, a Dirac spinner.
So it's multiplied by the indices of this gamma, right?
Okay, yeah. So these three are acted on by this 3x3. So suppose we just have a G alpha 1. Let's just take the first generator over there. All right, this is a sum of 8 generators. So right here we have a sum of 8 terms, because there are 8 different gluons. It multiplies these matrices, so that's going to be a sum of 3 terms by the time you combine. So some linear combination of those is going to be dotted into those. That's 3 terms. So 24 terms. Each of those 24 terms is a psi bar gamma alpha psi. So it's a Dirac sandwich. Okay, so you know, not hard, but, you know, just by sheer magnitude, overwhelming. So here we have lambda 1. So what's our lambda 1? We've got 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, acting on red, psi, blue, psi, green. And then we have plus 7 more terms.
So this is actually like a 9 by 9 matrix, right? Is that correct?
No, it's 3 by 3. That's the whole matrix right there. When I said 9 before, I should have said 3. Yeah, there are 9 components in here. But when I multiply that by this, right, this result is trivial. That's just going to be psi blue, psi red. That's an R.
What
it's
if
not they... R. It should be an R. Yeah.
So these ones are actually identities then?
They're ones.
Okay.
Number ones.
Okay.
It's just a numeric array.
So that means these sizes are scalars then?
No. They're identities in spinner space. Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So 4 component Dirac spinner, yeah, they're an identity in identity matrix in that space. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So 0, right? Psi B, Psi R, and then 0.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that simplifies things. Okay, and then 7 more terms for the other 7 gluons, which we won't look at the other 7. They're going to behave just like this one, or misbehave, we'll see. So here's minus a half. We've got, now what happens is we've got a sum of, what, here's a, going to be a psi bar red, and then this, you know, we can call that a G1 flash, right? The same way A flash for QED. And then that's going to combine with psi blue. And then the second term here is going to be psi blue and a G1 flash and a psi red.
Are the 7 more terms starting with the negative 1/2 or starting? It's the whole thing, or
yeah,
there?
It's the whole thing. It's the sum on the capital A here.
Ah.
So it's the different gluon sums with their corresponding lambda matrix.
Okay.
All right. So seven more pairs like this. So you're going to have 14 interacting pairs of colored quark spinners with the corresponding gluon gauge field. And now, well, that term looks a whole lot like what we looked at in QED. So each of these is, you know, like the QED interaction. But let's study what happens. Let's try and write a Dowd-Feynman diagram for that or something. Yeah.
So these gammas are... They're just the regular gammas, which give the space time metric then?
Yeah, same gammas that we did in QED.
Okay.
Space time.
Okay.
Got this
Maybe not.
What's the G? What was G in QED?
Little E, electric charge.
Okay.
A mu, the vector potential. It's a vector, right? G alpha.
Uh-huh.
That's like the vector potential, only now we've got 8 generators instead of 1.
Okay.
So we didn't need that extra capital A index on the QED.
Gotcha.
So it's the vector potential, it's the gauge field.
Okay.
They're the ones we introduced when we generalized the connection.
Okay,
so we're good here?
Okay.
Any questions over here?
So G's are the one form, right?
Yeah, Lie algebra value
okay,
one form.
Okay.
So they're Lie algebra values because they're summed on generators here, and they're one forms because they've got a down Lorentz index. Yeah, ask all the questions you want. You know, we'll pull out the details.
So there's no arbitrary constant in here, then? Or does it come with the?
Well, there's, you know, I could probably pull out. a charge here. You know, something like the fine pressure constant.
Right, right.
Let's call it alpha strong.
Right.
Let's go ahead and put that in. You know, I'm not sure if this is exactly where, you know, in your final cross section there would be alpha strong or alpha strong squared. And this number, okay, in QED, that coupling constant, you know, it's just product of two electric charges with H bar and C in appropriate places, but it comes out to 1 over 137, roughly. Right? This comes out to about 0.12. So, you know, bigger than a tenth. So the series doesn't converge nearly as fast as the QED perturbation series does. And there are so many interactions that the number of possible diagrams is going to go up much faster than QED. So, you know, you don't get convergence at all. It's the perturbation theory here is not very good. You need to do the lattice calculation. But pressing on. So we have 14 terms, each of which looks like minus alpha strong over 2, you know, perhaps some other constant. And here we've got a pi red. We've got Luon field number 1 / psi. Okay, so what does this do? This psi, remember, we're going to have an A and a B dagger expansion, right? You know, we solve the Dirac equation for these guys, and we end up with this integral over raising and lowering operators. So this B operator creates what? It creates a blue quark. And this A
destroys it.
Annihilate. Okay. Then this one. So here, you know, once again, we're going to have, you know, these are blue. These are going to be red ones. So we create and annihilate. Right.
One of those is the anti-quark, right?
The bars.
The bees?
Oh, yeah. Good, thanks. The bee creates an anti-quark. And then the bee here is going to create anti-red. Good. There, that's what I was missing. Or annihilate a red. So it either creates an anti-red or annihilates a red. That always lowers the red quantum number. This
those are barred, right? Those are,
should be that's a problem. Okay, so
good. A dagger B, right?
Thank you. This is exactly what's wrong. Okay, so we're going to create red or annihilate anti-red.
The B annihilates anti-red.
So,
mm-hmm.
These are the regular ones, the A and the B dagger. A annihilates a blue quark. B dagger creates a blue anti-quark. Over here, we've got the bar space. So we have an A dagger red that creates a red quark, and we have a blue that annihilates an anti-red quark. So same story, funny name. All right, so what happens? We can have, we have a quark going along, and let's suppose we have some sort of a blue quark coming in, and now we have a vertex, and coming out of that vertex we have a G1 gluon. Well, that G1 gluon, what can it do? It can annihilate that blue quark. And then what happens over here is that'll be the creation of a red quark. So we're going to get a red quark coming out. And so we have a different name for G1. G1 we can call a red anti-blue quark, gluon. You know, we could also, because right, it either creates an anti-blue or annihilates the blue. That lowers the blue number, and it either creates a red or annihilates an anti-red that elevates the red number. So this quark is appropriately called a red anti-blue quark. And you can see that this is going to happen with each of them. You know, all of those lambda matrices, you can run through, okay, exercise, you know, do the other seven. Or do one of the other seven. Figure out what the name of the quark should be. Right? What is it creating or annihilating? And, you know, so this is a possible vertex, and we have a vertex contribution here of, you know, we have the minus half alpha strong, you know, we probably have a minus I from the Hamiltonian. We have a gamma matrix. I'm not sure this coefficient is right. You know, don't trust that. But you can look up these Feynman rules or derive them very carefully, you know, through the same procedure we did with QED. But we have a very similar looking vertex operator here for the, in this case, the emission of a red anti-blue gluon. Of course, they can be absorbed, but this is the only interaction between the quarks and the gluon. We just have this one term, this minimal coupling in the covariant derivative that couples a copy of the gauge field to, well, what is the gauge field coupling to?
Can that gluon, the gluon can be a anti-red blue, can it?
An anti-red blue, okay, so how do we get an anti-red and a blue? Suppose...
You change the sign on this.
Let's see, so to annihilate an anti-red, yeah, so we have a... an anti-red is going backwards like that. So if we had a red anti-quark in the final state, so you know here we have like a V anti-red annihilated at this vertex, and what would come out would be, okay, so we've annihilated an anti-red, and here we need to, we've probably produced an anti-blue in the initial state. So, you know, that, you know, it could be an anti-proton, you know, something like that would have those quarks in it.
Okay.
Yeah, so either process is fine. This can produce either of those interactions. So, you know, what's this coupling to? Well, it's coupling to something that, you know, looks like, okay, there's a coupling constant. There's a pi bar gamma alpha pi with this lambda A. So the thing that the gauge field couples to is the conserved current that we derived last time, right? So just like we had A alpha J alpha in classical electromagnetism as the coupling between the free electromagnetic field and source current, here we have a coupling between these source currents, the quarks are source currents for colors, and the gauge field, the potential for the field strength for the free gluon field. So, quite analogous, 8 times as complicated. So, questions here?
Is that a JA at the bottom?
J. J alpha or A alpha. But okay, here, the coupling we have here is, okay, so, you know, this is V and M. This is QCD. In QCD, we have a J. That should be an A.
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
But still, yeah.
So, yeah, for each generator, we have a current, and that couples to GA alpha. Right. Good. So, let's look at the other diagrams then. What else can happen here? Yeah, I just said, oh, that's the only diagram for quarks and gluons. Well, except the other seven. You know? And so, you'll go home and quickly write down the other seven and see, oh, each gluon is associated with a pair of colors. It annihilates one and creates the other. Or annihilates the anti-one and creates the anti-other. But there are some other interactions that go on in QCD. Why? What are they?
There are cross terms from F.
Yeah.
F star F.
Yeah, right. So there are additional gluon interactions, and this is different than CNN. We did not have this in QED, but if we look at a non-abelian gauge theory, we have gluon-gluon interactions. They come from F alpha beta A, F alpha beta A. Like these things where, let's see if we remember what this field was. We had something like the curl of G, just like E and M, but also because the group is not abelian, we have some structure constants. Who knows what they are, but we have some structure constants here, and combined with a pair of gluon fields, like this. And now we put the square of that thing into the action. So this is going to give, let's go ahead and square it out. So we're going to have D alpha GA beta minus D beta GA alpha squared. Just sum on the capital A and then do the Lorentz sum on the alpha and beta. That's just like E and M. So, nothing new there. It's the kinetic term. You know, that's responsible for the gluon propagator. Right? That just take the gluon from here to there. Then we have a cross term. Probably we'll get to something like 2i of these, where this and that mix. So, we're going to have a structure constant. And then we'll have some derivatives, which makes the coupling momentum dependent. We'll see that in a minute. So that sums on the A, and then we have a G. You need to raise the Lorentz indices. G, C, beta, summed on the alpha beta here. But this is a three gluon derivative coupling. So, three gluons come together and interact. So you have a vertex with three gluon lines coming in. Then we have this term squared. F, B, C, A, F, A, C, E. Thank you.
And that is a four-gluon company. And we can write down the vertex operators for those. They're not actually terribly complicated. Well, they're long, but they're comprehensible. I won't derive them, but I'll show you what they are.
So now we're back to, now we have a theory again with a four vertex. Where, like when we were doing
a four
theory.
Yeah,
I put that quarter in.
Oh, okay. okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. Four gluon all linked at one point. Alright, well, that happens with probability 0.12. And, you know, one gluon turns into three with probability 0.12. Right? You know, every tenth moment, you have three times as many gluons. So, the force is very strong indeed.
Is there anything in the Lagrangian that has to do with why strong force is so, why there are no free gluons? Is there something in this, in the...
Yeah, it's the strength of the binding and the fact that the lowest energy state is the anti-symmetric one. So, yeah, you predict that, right? You look at what binds. So the strength of that coupling constant, you know, if you tune the strength of that coupling constant, you know, way down to, you know, 0.001 or something, in a theory like it is, then, you know, you would expect to see free Teller charge. So, in the electroweak interaction, okay, they're coupling to isospin. Well, do we see free isospin? Yeah, sure, proton neutron. You know, see it all the time. If the coupling constant alpha strong was sufficiently small, we'd see free Teller too. We'd create, you know, different combinations, different symmetries of color combinations. And we'd have a whole array of different particles as a result. Because you go to a higher energy state in a combination of your up and down particles, even you go to a higher spatial wave function, you know, you can do that. You know, it's just like, okay, take everything you know about atomic physics, hydrogen atoms, right? You've got these different, you know, spherical harmonic distributions of electron wave function. You know, the lobes and stuff, or the F state of the nice sphere, and, you know, you get up to D state and there's little spots everywhere. And, you know, the wave function is very weirdly distributed, but, you know, it just goes with the square of the spherical harmonics, really, to see where the probability is for finding an electron in various states. And the higher the angular momentum, or the higher the n quantum number, the higher the energy of that electron, or the less negative, because it's a bound state. Okay. Drop down a factor of 10 to the 5th, and now we're looking at a nucleus. So we've got a bunch of protons and neutrons in a nucleus. They're exchanging, you can think of them actually pretty well as exchanging pions. That model actually still works pretty well. But really, you know, it's gluon stuff going on. That's pretty dense. You're within the range of in which the strong force is strong. So on a scale of about a Fermi, right, there are excited levels of nuclei. Right? So you can produce an excited level of a nucleus and you'll get characteristic radiation from it, and it's not in the 13.6 eV range like hydrogen, it's in the probably MeV range, right? The energy levels of the deuteron are like 2.2 MeV to split a deuteron, I think, something like that. But, you know, it's a lot more energy. You get more energetic radiation. It takes a lot more energy to raise the energy level, but you get an excited nucleus of whatever atom you've put energy into. Okay, now drop down another level and look inside one of those particles, say the proton, and you've got three quarks and a billion gluons. And now the energies, the ambient energies are so strong that there are, you know, gazillions of these exchange particles going on, and the quark masses, 1 or 2 MeV, are negligible compared to the mass of that whole bound state, just because there's so much energy binding the thing together. It's a very relativistic system. And now you can expect the up and down quarks to higher energy levels. Right, so well, what does that look like? Well, it's a particle called a D, I think. I mean, there are, you give it a whole other name because its mass is 10 times the mass of the proton. And the proton spectrum, the spectrum of excitation, is actually a spectrum of different particles with, you know, increasingly high masses. Okay, a GeV for the proton, you know, 10 or 20 GeV for the, I forget whether it's a D or a delta or, you know, there are several, you know, particles on up that are regarded as just excited states of the proton. They're still comprised of two up and a down quarks, right? They're just in some different configuration. And similarly for the other particles we see. So you have to define whether, oh, are we seeing a new particle? Is there like a charm quark in there? Or is it just some excited state of the proton? And you see both. You see both. Okay. So let's draw some pictures for these things. The free gluon interaction, you have, lo and behold, three gluons. So you're allowed to draw a vertex like this in any of your Feynman diagrams for QCD. That's fine. What do you associate with the vertex? Well, it's complicated enough, I have to look at my notes. But it's something like this, you know. Remember, one of the exercises I think I asked you to do is to show that the structure constants for Fe3 actually are totally anti-symmetric. So imagine totally anti-symmetrizing the ABC here. So you actually get, you know, some terms with the momentum of this quark and some with the momentum of that and some with the momentum of that. The A, B, and C could fall on any of these equally well. The derivative, where a momentum space pulls down a momentum. So what you're going to get, you know, normally you get some symmetric, but you're going to get symmetric anti-symmetrized with factors of the momentum. So if I have, say, P, Q, and R as the four momenta here, then the vertex, okay, we've got some coupling, we've got a structure constant, and then we have three terms, eta, alpha, beta, t minus q, mu, and then we divide mu, alpha, t minus r, beta, and eta, beta, mu, r minus p, alpha. So this is the propagator you stick in, or I'm sorry, this is the vertex contribution you stick in when you have one of these quark vertices. Then finally, four gluon interactions. This is just a pure thing, that, and then in this one you can just build out the dendrite and the structure constants, but the terms are lengthy. The vertex contribution here is minus I times the coupling constant squared, because, okay, you know, imagine there's, if we put a G here, then we would have a G here, but we would have a G squared here for the coupling strength. So, you know, if G is 0.12, then G squared is 0.01. So this one isn't as likely. It really counts as a second order thing.
But here's what it looks like. FEAC, and then metric. Alpha mu, theta, theta nu, anti-symmetron. Alpha mu, theta. And then we have two more terms like that. We have to cycle the indices around. So we have mass FEAC, FEBB, and a similar factor, alpha nu, eta, mu, beta. These cycles, and these indices, remember each of these gluons have one of each kind of index. You know, it'll have like an A and an alpha on it. So we label each of these gluons. I don't have the picture here, but you know, we have a G, B, beta, G, C, mu, G, D, nu. So as the A, B, C, D shuffle, so do the alpha, beta, mu, nu. And then here, eta, alpha, beta, eta, mu, nu. And finally, F, EAD, F, EDC, eta, alpha, beta, eta, nu, mu, minus eta, alpha, mu, eta, nu, beta. So that's the vertex contribution for the four gluon interactions. These are the same as the weak interaction, okay? Any Yang-Hill theory is going to have these same combinations, just different structure constants. So I won't write these down again when we get to the weak interaction, but the weak intermediate vector bosons can do these same things. The F's in this are going to guarantee that at that vertex, color is conserved. Right, we'll get conservation, so if A really stands for a red anti-blue, and B stands for a blue anti-red, the ones that are going to come out are also going to cancel. Right, there's going to be no net color going out if there's no net color going in. Or if there's a net red coming in, there's a net red going out, and so on. And that will be guaranteed by the structure constant. The whole structure of the theory has that conservation law. It preserves that U1 charge, preserves color charge. And so, that's sort of all I plan to talk about on the strong interaction. So, you know, anything you guys want to look at to do with strong interactions, ask away.
You said this is really looked at as a second order because of the G squared.
Yeah. It's going to be suppressed by 0.12.
Okay. And the
it's still bigger than alpha. it happens.
What's the coupling constant for weak? Like, how strong is that? Over. Is it weaker than EM?
I don't know offhand. It's weak.
It's the weakest of the three,
right? Yeah, because, you know, the weak interaction cross-sections get suppressed by the mass of the W and Z, which is like 80 GeV or 90 GeV. The coupling constant itself, at high energy, they're all the same. All the coupling constants actually converge to the same thing because they're running coupling constants. They depend on momentum. But at low energy, the weak is truly weak. It's not terribly different than the fine structure constant. I think it's more that it's suppressed by the mass of the gauge bosons.
Okay.
We're going to introduce, when we do the weak next time, we're going to introduce a G and a G prime, two coupling constants, one for weak hypercharge and one for the SU2. And those two are related by the cosine of 22 degrees or something, the Weinberg angle relates those two. So, you know, a factor on the order of one. Well, the electromagnetic, the QED coupling constant, still have those.
And the weak coupling constant is built out of those. So they can't be all that different.
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, factors of the order of, you know, finite 22 squared or something, you know, could come in there. But, you know, not much more than that. But the big suppression of those interactions is that it takes 80 GeV to make a W. That's a little harder to do
with
neutron decay or, you know, electron photon scattering. Doesn't take any energy at all to make a photon. Well, it depends on the photon. So, yeah, very, very easy to get.
Does that correspond to time in the universe?
To time?
To a given time in the course of the Big Bang.
80 GeV. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, when was the ambient energy 80 GeV? Well, you know, sometime for sure, and there were probably lots of W's around at that point. As the universe was cooling, you know, you hit 80 GeV and suddenly you get this resonance and there are going to be W's everywhere. I'm making this up. I don't know if that happened, but you know, yeah, sure. Before recombination, okay. Well, recombination is what, maybe a million years after t equals zero, that imaginary point t equals zero, and then the energy is basically ground state of hydrogen. So ambient energy 13.6 eV. You can bind an electron to a proton and expect it to stay put after that. Before that, you know, the average energy was going to knock that electron off. So in a very short time, suddenly all the electrons go poof on the protons, and now you've got a bunch of hydrogen and helium. So that's a million. Well, the temperatures, you know, as you go back, it's going up quickly. Let's see. How far back do you have to go before it's GeV? I'm not sure. You know, say 1,000 years. You know, T equals 1,000 years, something like that. I'm not sure where it is. You can find charts of it laid out. I don't have the numbers floating around my head. But, you track it back. You know, Weinberg's book on this, the first 3 minutes. That's a good one. That's when all the particle physics happens. Or all the particle physics is at this level. I mean, there's interesting stuff before that. But, you probably don't do much better than a book like that for, you know, looking at the particle synthesis when, you know, first you have a quark gluon soup. You know, the ambient energy is higher than the binding energy of protons and neutrons and stuff, and you just have all these quarks and gluons bouncing off each other, some electrons and photons, things like that. W's and B's, I suppose, would be around some sort of abundance, probably overwhelmed by the gluons, though. And things expand, things cool, and eventually you form a stable quark combinations, protons and neutrons. And, you know, then there are still a lot of photons around. At that point, are we going to be making W's and B's? Well, let's see, what's it take to disrupt a proton? I mean, okay, a GeV, you know, a GeV collision of protons could, you know, certainly form a mess of pions or something. So you could be mucking up your protons and neutrons pretty badly at GeV energies, but you're too cool to be producing W's and Z's in any great abundance. So the W's and Z's freeze out earlier than that. When you do cosmology of this sort, particle cosmology, it's a big field these days. It's really cool stuff. You generally talk not in terms of, well, for a while you talk in terms of redshift. You know, the distance to something is the redshift, because you're doing astrophysics and trying to, the redshift is the thing you measure, and you just get used to, oh, a redshift of 2, it's 12 billion years ago, something like that. But then you get back to the early universe, and your time scale is in temperature. The most convenient thing to use is the the ambient energy, because that tells you what physical processes are going on. And, you know, gradually you get, you know, one after another thing freezing out. So the W's and Z's will go away first, and then you'll start binding up the quarks, and then some while later the electrons and protons bind. And at that point, that one I do remember is about a million years or so after the Big Bang. You've got essentially everything is settled into hydrogen and helium and photons. And those photons, remember, scatter off charges. They like to scatter off free charges. So after you form the hydrogen and helium, there are not nearly as many free charges around. There are essentially none. And so the photons just keep going in the direction they were going. They now fairly rarely scatter. So those photons that haven't scattered since a million years after the Big Bang, that is now the microwave background. So any direction you look in the universe, you see the 2.7 Kelvin background of photons. And those are photons that have been traveling pretty much along their present path ever since a million years after the Big Bang.
Why didn't they just shell away?
From where? It's homogeneous. Right? Cosmology is isotropic and homogeneous.
Well,
no,
from
no preferred direction.
From the given time...
There's no point in the bang.
Right, but there was a time when suddenly the universe was transparent to the photons.
Right.
Why wouldn't they shell away in that kind of thickness? If they're not...
A shell of photons.
From what point?
From anywhere
in the sphere.
No sphere. Not necessarily a sphere. Right. In fact, the indication is at this point that it's an open universe. So at the time of the Big Bang, the universe is... Well, you don't know what the topology is, but an instant after the Big Bang, the universe is infinite. Spatially infinite. Every point in it looks the same. So, yes, there's a shell around every point in this infinite universe. So whatever direction you look, you're looking at one of those shells all the time.
But isn't it often described as a given size? At this point, during... It's going to be a given diameter?
It's described badly. All right. The diameters that are given are probably the diameters of the visible universe. Okay, so as we look back, we're looking along our path light cone. We never see outside of that path light cone. But given an open universe, what's beyond the bounds of that light cone looks just the same as what we see inside that light cone. So we're only seeing this circle wall or this sphere of what's out there. What are we seeing? We look out in every direction, so we see a two-dimensional sphere. And as we look out further, we're seeing that same sphere another sphere at an earlier time. We're just seeing this section through the universe. But it's proven to be a very sound assumption that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. You know, after a while it starts sounding silly saying we're at the center of things. And it equally sounds silly saying that, that point there was the center, because it doesn't really jive with the experimental data. You know, the isotropy, homogeneity, uniform temperature... to 5-6 figures of background radiation is really good evidence that things were very homogeneous on large scale. So that, it would be very tough to make an argument that any one location in the universe looks very much different at, say, recombination. These COBE maps, and there are better ones now, of irregularities in the background radiation. You've seen these things, and they're definite, like dark spots. That's in the fifth significant figure.
right? The temperature is 2.71532, you know, plus or minus, you know, 3. You know, you get down to that level, those are the fluctuations they're measuring in those experiments. So the homogeneity of the universe, the idea that, you know, any two points in the universe are going to be seeing essentially the same kind of picture, is very strong. Very strong. I've tried to build models. And, you know, you can build a model where, oh, it blew up from a point, right? And, you know, everything is on this sphere. But now you've got to account for the homogeneity. So you have to make that sphere really, really big before it starts to look, in a small neighborhood here, it starts to look homogeneous. Because the expansion is different radially than tangentially to a sphere. And, you know, it's really hard to make a model like that, you know, have those two directions within the limits of experiment. Other models you can push on hard and, you know, kind of crank them into place. But, so the issue is, you know, what is the topology? So at 1 second after the Big Bang, what is the spatial shape of the universe like? Well, it's pretty close to flat. It's pretty close to a Euclidean three space. You know, it's slightly positively or negatively curved. Well, if it's, you know, positively curved, you've got, you know, something that's, you know, saddle shaped at each point. You know, that's hard to draw. But we can draw it at one point, but it's got to look like that at every point. So if you've got a slight positive curvature, you've got that. If you've got a slight negative curvature, then, you know, it may curve around into some sphere, but it could be arbitrarily large. And this is, you know, like an arbitrarily short time after the Big Bang, you know, it can be, it could be pretty much either of those shapes if you have the, if it's homogeneous and isotropic. You know, those are the possibilities. It can only be flat or a sphere or a saddle. And you trace this back to t equals zero. Well, the point t equals zero doesn't exist, so you don't know what space looks like if t equals zero. You can do a one-point compactification. Okay, add one point, identify that with the limit of every curve in space-time. But it's like taking, poke a hole in a sheet of paper. Now, what is that topologically? Lines around that hole are lines. You know, what's the length of that line? It depends on the metric. What does it shrink down to a point? Well, there is no point there, so it can't. So you can't say, oh, well, really, if we're looking at a sheet of paper, there's a hole, because the hole is never there. So aside from experiments that, you know, look at rates of expansion or that, you know, look at resonances around a sphere. So if it is spherical, then maybe there are preferred wavelengths associated with the circumference. People look for that. I'm not found convincing evidence that, you know, there's, you know, maybe, you know, that's tough measurement to do. But, you know, it's possible to develop evidence directly for, oh, you know, it actually is a sphere or a saddle. And the best measurements now are the type 1a supernovas that indicate that it's an open universe that's going to expand forever, and that means that it, at any positive time after the Big Bang, it's infinite. Now,